a Wednesday afternoon thing. Rich Kimble and Kerry Haskell and our 62nd man, Bruce Pratt, joining us in studio for Sports Lit 101.
Yeah. One of the things I love about doing this segment is how much I learn. I mean, I love coming in. I love doing it. I like being here. But I've really found this year in particular that I've learned a lot about things that happened when I was much younger and getting a different perspective. Now, anyone that ever saw Willie Mays leading John Roseboro off the field, his head covered in blood after being hit in the head with a baseball bat by Juan Marichal, won't forget that. I mean, I did not see the game live. I'm not going to pretend that I did.
65. Okay.
Yeah, it was August 22nd, 1965. What most people don't know is what happened immediately before that was Roseboro threw the ball back to the pitcher and purposely hit Marichal's helmet going by. they'd been knocking down and beating each other. And to put this in and there's some historical perspective on this that I did not as a 14-year-old understand. I understand better now. One of the things that we have to look at is a lot of people in New England have a very overinflated sense of the Yankees-Red Sox rivalry because it has always meant far more to the Red Sox than it did to the Yankees, because for the longest time, the Red Sox were not relevant in terms of pennants and World Series.
Right. It was a one-sided rivalry a lot of years.
Yeah, it was a one-sided rivalry, but the Dodgers-Giants was never one-sided. There was never a time where for a long period of time, one dominated the other. And that was a very intense rivalry. It was intense when it started in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, and it continued when they moved to California. A couple of quick historical things we need to remember. We've talked about this before. The Dodgers until Fernando Valenzuela, had a terrible relationship with Latino people because to build their ballpark in Chavez Ravine, Walter O'Malley was able to get the city to relocate hundreds of Mexican families, people that are living in their own houses. I mean, it's not some squatters camp. This was a neighborhood that was removed. And the Dodgers always had a very chilly relationship. I mean, the Giants with African-American players. I mean, a star like Willie Mays still found it difficult to rent an apartment, find a place to live, certain neighborhoods he wasn't really welcome. So it was those two teams had some internal problems. Marichal, of course, is from the Dominican Republic, so he had issues with the Dodgers, and Roseboro, African-American, had issues with the Giants that wound just the rivalry. Plus, we have to also remember that in 1964 and 5, we had a lot of strife in this country, including the great Watts riots, which burned down a good portion of Los Angeles. And John Roseboro lived right in that neighborhood. He did not live in Watts, but nearby, and actually would sit with a gun on his porch when things were getting out of hand. So he's got that going on in his life. And Marichal, like many other Dominican players, was very disturbed by the fact that the United States was called in to quell civil unrest in 1964 and 5 in the Dominican Republic. So at the time that this is going on, we have Marichal and the Dominican players worried about what's going on at home. Roseboro and a lot of African-American players very worried about cities burning down. And as we know, that was a summer of tremendous rioting. And though by the time August rolled around, the rioting was over and things were calming in the Dominican Republic, the Marichal-Roseboro brawl, the brawl that was precipitated by this incident became a legend. And it became a legend in a funny way because 50 years later, when they decided to look at it in 2015, 40 years later, Bill Plaschke of the Los Angeles Times and Gwen Knapp wrote about it, and they just wrote about it being a story of redemption, that Roseboro and Marichal forgave each other, that everything was fine in the end, and blah, blah, blah. Well, here's what's interesting. That's all because they only read major media stories from the Los Angeles Times and the San Francisco Examiner and the like. But what was going on at the time was there were two other very important newspapers involved in this. One was the Los Angeles Sentinel, and the other was La Opinion. Of course, I just said that with a French accent. It was supposed to be Spanish, but I don't speak Spanish. The Sentinel was a black newspaper, and La Opinion was a Spanish-language paper. And they had a very different take on all this. And the communities had a very different take on all this. And there were people that were enraged that the fact that Marichal would got a $1,700 fine and an 8-day suspension really ripped all kinds of people, especially in the white media. A Murray Kempton, people like that. Oh, it's terrible. You know, that's beyond anything civilized. He should have gotten much more. Dodgers fans felt the same way. But what's really interesting is how some of the papers that were geared toward minority interests and minority communities took a very different take on it. And their take was, well, you know, this began, this was the culmination of an escalation of events that, you know, and we're old enough to remember a lot more when there was a lot more chin music in baseball than there is today. You leaned in against Bob Gibson, you went down. And you didn't go down by getting hit in the butt. You went down because he buzzed you about an inch from your nose. And today, you know, the reason we don't see the bench clearing brawls and all that kind of stuff is A, in the American League, the pitchers don't hit. So you're not going to throw it.
That's a big factor.
Yeah, that's the big factor because you can throw at somebody and then nobody's going to throw at you, right? And the other factor is that these guys now are you know, much more media savvy and they're much more worried about, you know, the next contract. These guys back then were playing for their lives every year. And people forget also that Roseboro only was the starting catcher because of the terrible automobile accident, which left Roy Campanella paralyzed. And he was known as Gabby because he never talked, a catcher that didn't talk. Quiet, very intense on the field. They say the same thing about Marichal. He was an affable, friendly guy until he got on the mound. I don't know anybody ever said Bob Gibson was an affable, friendly guy. He was all business. But they say Marichal wasn't. When you look back on this, you got to also put it in perspective today. And that what I was thinking about today, if this happened, what would the Fox News people have done? A Latin player hits an African-American player in the head. This would have been played into something that it never was originally. This was between two guys. One happened to be Latin American. One happened to be African-American. In today's climate, with all the fear and the heightened racial language and the like, you got to wonder that this would have become something completely bent out of shape. And when you look back at it now, it was a major event. Nobody has hit anybody in the head with a baseball bat on purpose since on a field. I mean, it was sort of the day that stopped, if you will.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is the Latin American press referred to Willie Mays as La Pacificador, or the peacemaker, or the one who made it calm, because apparently he was able to say to Roseboro as he was walking him off, don't let this get out of control. Don't let this go too nuts or get away from us. It was really interesting to look back on it because I remembered it as more or less, if you'd asked me, was it what provoked it, I would have said, well, they'd been throwing at one another. But I didn't remember that Roseboro had purposely clipped Marichal's batting helmet with his throw back to the pitcher. And a lot of people, they say, should take some of this blame. Don Drysdale, who was known to buzz you from time to time, some of the other players, they said that Maury Wills and some of the other black players were really angry about this, and they thought it was a shot at them. So it was really interesting to go back. And this is from an article by Samuel O. Regalado. I don't know how you said Regalado, I think. And it's in Replays, Rivalries, and Rumbles. We've just got a few more great ones in here, though. We're going to hopefully take a break next time. But it's really fascinating because, you know, when people do research, they often don't go to those old ethnic newspapers and old racially significant newspapers or community newspapers to get a different take. I mean, if all you're going to get is the Los Angeles Times and the Examiner's take on it, you're going to miss a lot.
I love Juan Marichal, one of my favorites.
High kick.
I tried to copy that high kick as a
I did too. The first time I did it, I fell over at Little League practice.
You look at some of his numbers through the years. 1963, he had a record of 25-8, a 2.41 earned run average, started 40 games, completed 18 of them, and threw 321 innings.
Yeah, and he threw hard.
Yeah.
I mean, he did have great junk, but he threw hard. The other thing about him, too, is he was 19-9 when he hit Roseboro. And he had beaten the Dodgers three times at home that year.
He won 20 games in 5 out of 6 years. And his best season ever, talking about bad timing, was 1968. One of the great seasons a pitcher's had. He was 26-9, 2.43, 30 complete games. 30 complete games. There won't be 30 complete games in all of Major League Baseball this year, the way they're going. 325 innings pitched that year. And he didn't win the Cy Young. Why? Well, because that's the year Bob Gibson had a 1.12 earned run average.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, I just think pitchers were tougher.
What uniform was Juan Marichal wearing when he won his last Major League game?
Ooh, that's a good question, because I came across that when I was doing some research. Mets?
Boston Red Sox.
Red Sox, that's right.
He went 5-1 for the Red Sox in 1974 at the age of 36, came back and pitched very briefly with the Dodgers the next year before retiring. But boy, what a career. Lifetime, 243 wins.
Right, and that was the irony, that he finished his career with the Dodgers.
Yeah, right.
But that's a rivalry that if people think they, you know,
and it
Cubs,
still
Cardinals,
is.
Oh, yeah. Cubs, Cardinals, Yankees, Red Sox, Mets, Phillies, whatever you want to talk about. That, to me, is the rivalry in baseball that has the most zing to it.
What's next week on Sports Lit?
Well, I think we're either going to talk about the 1972 Olympic basketball game, which we'd all like to forget, or we're going to be talking about a book on wilderness that I just got the other day from Nebraska. Great-looking book. It really talks about the role that sportsmen have played in saving wild places. Mm. And not just individuals, but I've just looked at the book clearly. But I mean, you take companies like Orvis that have given millions of dollars over the years to try and preserve or to rebuild streams and the like. Yes, some of it is because it does well for your corporate bottom line, but it is the sense that there are a group of sportsmen who are beginning to really seize the environmental movement. And they were in the past, you know, pretty silent. I don't know if you saw in the New York Times yesterday or the day before, winter is now gone officially from New Jersey. New Jersey no longer has winter. Hopatcong Lake used to supply the ice for New York City. And that all the New England states and New Jersey are the most affected by climate change.
We'll be talking about that on Good, Bad, and Ugly, because particularly troubling news for the state of Maine.
Yes, very troubling.
You mentioned the outdoors, and while we have a moment, give a tip of the cap to our friend John Holyoke of the Bangor Daily News. I don't know if you saw the news. He's got a brand new book coming out this fall called Evergreens, a collection of some of his outdoor writing from through the years.
Oh, good.
Which I always like, because it's, John points it out, it's written from a different perspective. John didn't grow up in the woods as a traditional outdoorsman. He takes more of a layman's approach, and I think it's a fresh look at that type of writing.
I always thought that he was so good at writing about fishing in Maine, because he didn't come from that background. Mm. He didn't talk about, when I was a boy, we could catch whatever. And, I mean, he would tell people, you can catch trout in the Kenduskeg. You just got to go up there and go with someone you're knowing. Yeah, I always liked that about John.
Island Port Press publishing the book.
Yep, and that's a very, very good press, Island Port.
I was out the other day, but I don't know if either one of you have had the chance. I was a little late to the party, but have either of you walked along the refurbished Brewer waterfront?
Yes.
Yes, not long ago.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful walk.
Wow. And I was out there the other day with the dog, and I think I saw four different people fishing along the way.
And they're catching all kinds of interesting stuff now that the river's much cleaner, including some big sturgeon.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, as I've said on the show before, Bangor and Brewer did not make the mistake that most cities made and build the highway right alongside of the river. And that has got more to do with the renaissance of those two towns, I think, than anything else.
No, I agree with you on that. What down the road? We got some good books coming our way for the fall season.
Yeah, we do. We've got a book called Unbeautiful Watchers, which is about the pernicious way and that way fandom and fanboys are affecting sports. I think we're going to like that. I hope we're going to talk to Joe Dixon about Stealing Signs, the book that I talked about last week. Got a slew of new books coming in from Nebraska, from Syracuse. But a lot of those won't arrive until October.
Yeah, we've got a new one from our friend Michael Powell of the New York Times.
Oh, yeah.
And this doesn't even come out until November, but they sent us the advance copy so we can talk to Michael about it this fall, called Canyon Dreams, basketball season on the Navajo Nation.
Yeah, who's
Michael Powell.
Yeah, but who's the publisher?
It's Blue Rider Press.
Blue Rider, yeah. I just got on their mailing list, Blue Rider, so I will know more about the books they're doing. No shortage of good books, but you have a lot of books coming out in the fall. Some of the titles I can't remember off the top of my head, but they'll be with us soon.
Excellent.